mind some evolutionary ideas about why mammals consume the placenta, mammalian mothers. Some animal research and observational and experimental studies which have been done, and there's been over 40 years of experimental work with animal models done by Mark Crystal in the State University of New York. We'll talk a little bit about those, hit the highlights. Talk about the absence of human maternal placentophagy as a traditional practice, and the current emerging trend of maternal placentophagy. In the US, in Spain, in the UK, even I guess a little bit here in Germany, and elsewhere. A few public trend implications, and then finally some future research directions with my colleagues here in Jena. So the story of the placenta, and thus placentophagy, really begins 250 million years ago or so with the therapsids. And these reptiles, the therapsids, were ancestors of modern mammals, the monotremes, marsupials, and placentals, or eutherian mammals. The monotremes are those rare egg-laying mammalian oddities, such as the platypus, the deck-billed platypus, and the spiny anteater. And they enjoy two of the three major breakthroughs in theraspid evolution. Those three were internal body temperature regulation, body hair, and lactation. Although monotremes feed their young without the use of nipples, interestingly enough. The monotremes split off from the marsupials and the eutherians about 166 million years ago. The marsupials, of which there are over 300 known species, have a placenta like eutherian mammals, like ourselves, but it is a simple placenta, and offspring are often born early and finish developing outside of the uterus in a pouch, as we all know. The eutherians, over 4,000 species of placental mammals, eutherian mammals, split off from their marsupials about 160 million years ago and have a great diversity of placental types, shapes, and sizes. One of the additional ways to differentiate placentas is by how deeply they embed into the uterine wall. I don't have to tell placental experts and researchers here that. And apes and rodents, for example, have hemiochromal placentas that root deeply in the maternal uterine blood supply, but not all mammals do. The word placenta actually derives from the Latin placos. The word placenta derives from the Latin placos, meaning flat plate or disc, and it was first recorded in the writings of the Italian professor of anatomy and surgeon, Rialdo Colombo, in 1559. So, again, a variety of different placental types. I'll show a figure of those in a moment. And then again, as I mentioned, uterine invasiveness in terms of into the blood supply. So much for our very, very quick history. Evolutionary history lesson. So despite variable placenta shape and uterine invasiveness, and these are different shapes and sizes of placentas in this figure down below, the discoid type is of course the type for humans, all placentas serve essentially the same function for mammals. They bring food and oxygen from the mother to the developing fetus. They excrete waste products back to the mother for disposal. They manufacture products vital to sustain pregnancy, a host of hormones, for example. And they filter harmful substances in the mother's circulation. Not all substances, but certainly some. The diverse shapes, sizes, and structures of the placenta are another reason to marvel at it, this incredible product of evolution. why did nature make so many different kinds of placentas? No other organ in the body shows this degree of variation. For the most part, comparative biologists tell us kidneys look like and function like kidneys, hearts look and function like hearts, lung like lung, but not so for the placenta. So another aspect of its enigmatic nature. What is placentophagy? Placentophagy, we talk about it as eating the placenta. For those that have studied this in natural settings as well, it is the consumption of placental tissue, which the vast majority of mothers consume at least part of, if not all, but also amniotic fluid and placental membranes during and after parturition. And I say during because, especially with respect to amniotic fluid for mammals such as rodents who have large litters, they're licking the vaginal opening throughout the process of delivery, and so they're gaining potentially some of the benefits of placenta, as we'll see, placentophagy actually during delivery. Placentophagy is ubiquitous across eutherian taxa. It's essentially universal among land mammals. This includes rodents, lagomorphs, ungulates, carnivores, and our closest living primate relatives. So all of the apes, gorillas, chimps, bonobos, they all consume the placenta. The mother does postpartum. Essentially all monkey species do as well. Now, while placentophagy is known in essentially all land mammals, not all mothers in every species engage in placentophagy. And in fact, in some cases, a mother may engage in placentophagy in a later pregnancy, but not in an earlier one. And some never will at all, where others always will with every delivery. So there's considerable variation across taxa with respect to how often mothers engage in this. A horse is a good example. 10% or so of horse mares, mothers, consume the placenta, a very low percentage, whereas more than 80% of rodents and cow mothers consume the placenta. So real variation there, but known in every species other than humans as a traditional practice. So there are lots of ideas about why mammalian mothers eat the placenta. We know from observational studies that they do, that it's a ubiquitous trait. Why do they do it? Plenty of ideas about this, although a few of them have been tested very rigorously. So a lot of good stories about why that might be the case, but in terms of testing these hypotheses, we don't have a whole lot of data yet, other than the work of Mark Crystal. So the big ones, when I'm at a cocktail party, and people find out what I do, and I say something about, well, one of the things I'm interested in is why mammalian mothers eat the placenta, people say, oh, well, in nature, that's obvious. We know why. Mothers do it to avoid predation. They eat the placenta to avoid attracting predators that would kill and eat their young. It's a reasonable idea, sort of a common sense idea. Another one is general maternal hunger following birth. Labor, as the name implies, is a lot of work, I'm told by my wife. You are spending a lot of energy, and of course you would want some food, some energy after this difficult, arduous process, and there's a perfectly good placenta there, why not eat that? You don't even have to go far. That's another idea that's been proposed. A third evolutionary argument has been the temporary shift to carnivory, so that there's something about the special nutritional demands of the difficulty of pregnancy, the amount of energy and effort required for pregnancy that leads even herbivores to become carnivorous with respect to the placenta after birth. And then finally, the acquisition of placental hormones, and the placenta makes many, many hormones, as most all of you know, that might enhance maternal care. And this would be things like prolactin may improve a mother's ability to lactate and provide milk for her young. So these have all been proposed, and there are some others, but these are the leading ones over the last several decades. We have considerable observational experimental animal data that refute the first three of these. So they're just not very satisfying just based on observational and a few experimental studies. First of all, with respect to predator avoidance, this doesn't seem like a good general explanation because, first of all, apex predators consume their placentas. So lions, for example, consume their placentas and they don't have any natural predators. So that's one fly in the ointment, one difficulty with that. Maybe more to the point, non-nesting animals consume their placenta. So many ungulates are referred to as either followers at birth. This little lamb up here is a follower. Shortly after she's born, just as with horses, the mother will nudge the offspring to their feet. And when she moves off in the area where she gave birth, immediately after birth, the offspring will follow her, hence the term followers at birth. And they can travel a pretty significant distance even in the first day or so. Hiders are another strategy that some ungulates have. Cattle, for example, goats are hiders rather than followers at birth. And after the young is born, the mother will hide it. Typically, this is in open grassland areas. They'll hide it in an area where predators wouldn't be able to see it. And then she'll go off and forage after giving birth and then come back to her newborn, oftentimes many hours later, who's hidden down in the tall grass. So these are two very common strategies for ungulates at birth across many, many species. And if the predator avoidance hypothesis were really what's going on, if that was the reason for placentophagy, cleaning up the nest site, avoiding predation, one would imagine we would see less placentophagy with followers, right? Because they're leaving the area anyway. There's no need. In fact, in some cases, it might be good for a predator to come and consume the placenta rather than the baby. And in fact, we see that the percentage of species that are followers versus hiders at birth is about the same, 30 to 50%. So they're equal. So that also is a problem with the predator avoidance model. Finally, with the predator avoidance model, and this is true with primates, with apes, who often gives birth in trees. So chimps, for example, give birth in trees. And very oftentimes, when they do, the placenta will end up falling to the floor of the forest. And there's been many observational studies with chimps and other primates where the mother will actually, with the neonate clinging to her, she'll climb down from the relative safety of the trees right after giving birth to get the placenta in order to eat it. So if she was mostly interested in avoiding predation because of the placenta, this doesn't seem like a very good a very wise behavior. And this has been seen many, many times in the wild across a range of primate species. So the predator avoidance hypothesis doesn't hold a whole lot of water. As for general maternal hunger following birth, well, we see plenty of placentophagy in species where the mother doesn't decrease food intake prior to birth. Giraffes, for instance, rats, they'll eat right up to the time that they give birth, and so presumably they have plenty of energy and they don't need additional food. And with respect to temporary shift to carnivory, rat and mouse mothers, for example, prefer the placenta over many other delectable types of meats. So you can give them liver, you can give them fresh beef and pork, and give them the choice between that and the placenta, and every time they'll take the placenta. There's something about the placenta that drives them to consume it. Now, I didn't mention anything about this last one. We'll come back to the issue of acquisition of placental hormones, because there is some evidence to suggest that there may be some benefit here. So experimental and animal studies, this is almost all done with rodents, with rats and with mice, have identified several benefits and effects of placentophagy for the mother. Remember, this is always maternal placentophagy thus far, mom eating the placenta of the neonate. And what do these include? Well, the first, and I think one of the most exciting and interesting aspects of placentophagy is a molecule, a factor that Mark Crystal from the University, State University of New York, who has worked on placentophagy with animal models for about 30 years, identified. And they call this factor POEF. That's placental opioid enhancing factor. This is not an opioid itself, but it facilitates its action. It improves the pain-reducing effect of endogenous opioids that the mother produces during periods of pain, like labor. So it's an endogenous opioid analgesia enhancing effect. Again, it's not an opioid itself. There are neurochemical effects that also that include POEF that appear to enhance attraction and caretaking behavior. So for mothers, and this is done experimentally, for mothers who are allowed, rat mothers for example, or who are allowed to eat their placenta after giving birth versus rat mothers who are not allowed to eat their placenta after giving birth. The ones who eat the placenta overcome their initial avoidance of the pups, particularly with virgin mothers. This is common, that after they give birth, she'll take some time before she'll go over and begin grooming behaviors and nursing behaviors. And rat moms that eat the placenta overcome this trepidation, this fear of their own offspring, much sooner than moms who don't. So they approach their young sooner, and then they also engage in more caretaking behaviors, more licking behaviors, grooming behaviors, and they also start to feed sooner. So these caretaking behaviors have been very, very carefully studied under multiple conditions, and the result is always the same. The attraction to the offspring and the caretaking behaviors seem to be enhanced with moms who are allowed to eat the placenta versus those that are prevented from eating it. There has been one good study looking at effects of lactogenic hormones, and it's very, very old, but it does appear as though there may be some reason to think that it enhances lactation and feeding for the mother. Very difficult to study this with rodents. It's hard enough with human mothers because you have to weigh the infants and so forth and be very careful about the timing. I think that's the reason that more of these studies haven't been done. But one early study suggests that this may indeed be the case. Quickly, some effects can extend to non-maternal placentophagy. So we focus on the moms eating the placenta, but in fact, in some species, this also includes other adults who consume the placenta at the time of birth. So those enhanced caretaking benefits I was talking about up here for the mom, they can extend to placentophagic female siblings. So from an earlier litter, when the mom has another litter, some of the females from that earlier litter will oftentimes accompany her while she's delivering, and they'll consume some of the amniotic fluid and the placenta, and those animals are more likely to engage in the ones that are there that are allowed to do so, are more likely to engage in caretaking behaviors as siblings of the litter than females who are there who are not allowed to consume the placenta or amniotic fluid. Rather interesting. And then there's also examples of biparental species. There's a biparental hamster and California mouse fathers who consume the placenta along with the mother after after parturition. This is unusual, but there are some biparental species. And in almost all these cases, for hamsters and biparental mice, the father will consume the placenta and amniotic fluid with the mother. And then they'll engage in parental behaviors as well, especially grooming. And it appears that just like with the males that consume the placenta or the siblings, it decreases anxiety, so they approach the offspring sooner and they engage in caretaking behaviors more readily and more extensively. Interestingly enough, this POEF seems to be highly conserved, evolutionarily speaking, so that humans have it. We have POEF in our amniotic fluid and in our placental tissue. And in fact, you can, in the laboratory, you can feed a rat mother human placenta and compare that to a rat mother who is eating rat placenta, and the effects will be the same. So whatever is happening in terms of POEF and in terms of pain reduction, pain analgesic effect pain reduction, the factor has been conserved for humans, and it works across species. So a human, cow, mouse, dolphin placenta, they've all been found to contain POEF, and when you test them in rats, it has the same effect. That suggests something very interesting, evolutionarily speaking. Anything that highly conserved is likely to have an important function, an important benefit. So what about humans? Thank you for bearing with me on that evolutionary journey. When are we going to get to humans? We're here. In the early 1990s, William Ober, as an anthropologist, documented a handful of cultures around the world where placentophagy has been used for therapeutic or magico-religious purposes. But not maternal placentophagy. So all of there was a handful of these, I think around 10 societies that Ober identified where placenta is consumed for therapeutic, medical, or magico-religious purposes. None of these instances were the mother consuming of the placenta of her neonate. Her own placenta, if you will. These are all instances of someone else consuming placenta, the father or someone else in the community or someone that they didn't even know. We were interested, my graduate student and I, Sharon Young, who Sophia and Yana know, and who is a former PhD student and a collaborator, we were determined to find out if there were any examples of some human society somewhere that engaged in maternal placentophagy. I mean, this is a ubiquitous trait among mammals. Our closest primate relatives do it. There seem to be some reasons why it might be beneficial. Surely, we thought, there's some culture somewhere. My wife works with a small, she's also an anthropologist. She works with the Hadza hunter-gatherers of Tanzania. Surely, we thought, there are some small-scale, technologically simple society somewhere that has placentophagy as a traditional cultural practice. They've just incorporated into their cultural traditions if it has these benefits. So we used a database that anthropologists use called the Human Relation Area Files, and we looked at 179 societies from around the world, trying to find one where human maternal placentophagy was a traditional cultural practice. And we didn't find evidence of any, which was really surprising. We both thought that we would definitely find some. So not one society of those 179 had a practice of consuming the placenta. And you might say, well, it wouldn't be in these ethnographies. Oh no, we found lots on the placenta. We found lots of information about what these societies would do with the placenta after birth, but it wasn't eaten. We found 100 societies, 100 of those 179 societies had very specific ideas about what one does with the placenta when you consume it. With the placenta after birth. The vast majority, so specific, oftentimes ritualized behaviors associated with the placenta, ceremonialized. More than any other practice, burial, a ritual burial of the placenta was the most common, far and away. But there were other ritual ways of treating the placenta too, including intentional placement. Sometimes that was in a tree, on some sort of scaffold, a particular location. And there was incineration in some cases as well. And this was, again, culturally prescribed. This was the proper thing to do with these placentas after birth. And typically the placentas were treated in a very respectful way. And again, the whole idea of a burial or an incineration sort of suggests this.
Excuse me.
Yes?
What does incineration mean?
Like cremate, to burn. To burn. And please feel free to ask for clarification, since my German is so bad. Okay. So this gets to an issue of why not humans and placentophagy. This is a question that drives my research to this day and has implications for clinical applications of placentophagy. Because as an anthropologist, when I look at the cross-cultural record, particularly when I see something that is so common in mammals, and then I see a human exception to that rule, and I can't find, given the incredible diversity of human cultures, I can't find one culture that has incorporated this ostensibly beneficial, protective, helpful behavior into their cultural traditions. That's a red flag. That's a warning flag for me as an anthropologist, because that suggests there's some problem with doing it for humans. Now, if that's the case, I mean, even things like, whenever I raise this point, astute individuals oftentimes say, well, we see plenty of examples of taboos across cultures. Cannibalism, for example. And in fact, many people are surprised to learn that we have lots and lots of examples, of ethnographic examples, of cultural traditions of cannibalism. Endocannibalism and exocannibalism, eating your own people, dead individuals from your own community versus those outside of your community. Not hundreds of them, but dozens in the historic and ethnographic record. It's usually in a highly ritualized context. It's usually not for survival or for nutritive value, but out of a sign of respect. So usually these are incorporated into funerary rites. And a small amount is eaten, but it's still consuming human flesh. And so even for what we might consider universal taboos like cannibalism, there's such diversity in human cultures that we can even find a dozen, at least, examples of this in the ethnographic record. In our look at the ethnographic record, zero. So again, red flag for me as an anthropologist. So one of the questions my students and I started asking is the absence of placentophagy evidence of what Darwin called purifying selection? And purifying selection is the removal of heritable traits, this could be behaviors like placentophagy, that are deleterious, that interfere with your ability to survive and reproduce. So the question my students and I started to ask was, does the complete absence of human maternal placentophagy as a traditional cultural practice indicate some sort of danger for humans? What unique human factor would make an otherwise ubiquitous mammalian behavior problematic for humans? Gorillas and chimps do it and seem to benefit from it. Why don't we do it? And why don't we benefit from it? Well, we've come up with two possibilities. These are hypotheses. One has to do with placental toxicity that may be unique to human beings, and the other has to do with infection associated with human placentas. The first of these increased toxicity has to do with the evolution of our species. We've been using fire. There's a big debate in anthropology right now. It's been going on for a very long time about how long humans or our ancestors have been using fire. Some people like Richard Wrangham from Harvard say almost 2 million years. Others suggest something much more modest, 250,000 years ago. Take your pick. Anywhere in there is fine. We've been using fire for a long, long time, at least 250,000 years. We have uncontrovertible evidence of it here. Could that have something to do with our lack of placentophagy? The other hypothesis has to do with protracted and difficult childbirth, and I've got the proper audience for this particular hypothesis. I'm very anxious to hear what my colleagues have to say about this. So the controlled use of fire first. Toxic heavy metals, fire, smoke, and ash. One of the things that separates us from all other animals is that we use fire. We control and use fire. And in fact, my wife tells me that among the Hadza, this group of hunter-gatherers that she works with, one of the last remaining hunter-gatherer groups on the planet in Tanzania, the women are constantly bent over, squatting next to and bent over fires. Small fires usually, they cook on them, they use them for warmth. The fires are built inside of their grass huts at night. They breathe a lot of this smoke all the time. And in fact, women probably breathe more of this smoke throughout their lives than men do, because they're around the domestic sphere and they're cooking more food. So we hypothesize that maybe, given that there are toxic heavy metals in fire smoke and ash, so think things like cadmium, arsenic, lead, that these things are in fire smoke and ash, that over time these would accumulate in a pregnant woman's placenta because the placenta can't filter out some of these toxins during pregnancy. Sometimes very efficiently, as with cadmium, relatively efficiently. Sometimes not very efficiently, as with methylmercury. But there's a range, and we know that the placenta does filter out some of these toxins. So our idea was, if women are exposed to a lot of fire, smoke, and ash, habitually, daily, for many hours, while they're pregnant, do we see a buildup of these toxins, of these heavy metals, in relatively high concentrations in the placenta, and then once they are delivered, once the placenta is delivered and consumed, it leads to severe poisoning, essentially, of the mother and potentially of the offspring through the breast milk. So placental accumulation of these toxic heavy metals and cadmium, we think, is probably the best, we hypothesize, was the best possibility because it is differentially removed, and then transmission to neonate via breast milk. This is just the sort of thing that we'd expect for purifying selection, right? This is the sort of thing that means offspring don't survive, people don't survive, and don't reproduce. This is a means then to eliminate the behavior. Placental infection risk with extended labor. Neonatal infection risk increases with protracted and obstructed labor. We know this. And placental infection, due to things like group B strep, and E. coli, among others, increase with that protracted labor. And neonatal transmission of strep infection via breast milk is possible. And so this is a very famous figure in anthropology, looking at the obstetric dilemma. Again, don't need to tell any of my esteemed colleagues here about this, but this is the difficulty of human childbirth. If any of you have ever seen a bonobo giving birth in the wild or a chimp, it's a pretty quick and easy thing. The infant just comes right out. Of course, that isn't the case with humans, and there's questions about how long childbirth has been difficult for humans, but likely at least the last 200,000 years. Oops, sorry. So the idea here is that with difficult labor and delivery, extended labor and delivery, that increases the chances of infection, and that then, of course, can be passed on to the baby. Yes?
Would you explain the black and white things?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, of course. So these are different species, different taxa of ancestral humans, as well as chimps. This is Pan right here. So this is the relative size of the infant's head versus the birth canal. So you can see why birth for chimps would be relatively simple. Come right out. And of course, here we are with humans. So we're talking about a very, very, very tight fit. This is Homo sapiens. Here, this last row is Homo sapiens, and you can see this is the need to turn the infant to get them through the birth canal. So these are two hypotheses that we had for maybe why placentophagy is a bad idea for humans. We need to know more about what the infection risks actually are. Sophia and Jana and Dr. Grubman are engaged in research right now that's beginning to answer those questions, but we need to know more. I'll get to the issue of the fire toxicity here in a little bit. We've actually looked at the accumulation of metals in post-industrial populations, like here in Germany and the US, and not surprisingly, they're very low. What they would be for the Hadza, who are still crouched over fires much of the day, is an open question. That also deserves new research. So the new contemporary health trend, and I'm sorry I'm going over, I'll try to move more quickly through the end here. The next few slides will just talk a little bit about the clinical implications. The contemporary health trend, placentophagy, folks, is well known in the U.S. Certainly a small percentage of American mothers consume their placenta, but almost everybody has heard of it and knows what it is, which I think is not the case here in Germany and in many other places. It's got a long history, and it seems to have started in the U.S. So the first reports that we can find anywhere, the first published accounts of maternal placentophagy are from the early 1980s in the home birth and natural birth communities in the U.S. And at that time, the first accounts are that women were taking the placenta after delivery in these home birth settings, and they were simply preparing it. They were cooking it into a stir fry or baking it into a lasagna or whatever, and then eating it with their families. And several women talked about how incredible they felt, and then this burst of energy, and they just felt wonderful and rejuvenated and so almost euphoric. And there were several of these accounts, these first-person accounts. Well, placentophagy seems to not have died out, but remained very, very rare throughout the 80s and 90s. So again, probably just a handful of women in the U.S. in these home birth and natural birth communities. But then something happened in the early 2000s, and that was encapsulation. So in the early 2000s, placenta encapsulation specialists, like some colleagues of mine in Las Vegas, started taking the placenta for women, mostly who were having home births, and they were preparing it for them and turning it into capsules. So they would go from this to this. And the traditional way that most placenta encapsulation specialists have done that is they rinse the placenta, strip it of its membranes, then they cook it, steam it, get it to an internal temperature of about 165 degrees Fahrenheit. Then they dehydrate it overnight, usually 8 to 10 hours, in a low temperature dehydrator. So it looks like beef jerky or dried beef. And then you grind it up in a blender, in a pulverizer, and then you can put it into these capsules. And women get 100 to 125 of these capsules in a standard placenta, and they take them anywhere from maybe 3,500 milligrams at the beginning, in the first week, and then they slowly wean off to the third week, they're taking about 1,000 milligrams a day. So start up at about 3,500 a day and end up at about 1,000 a day 3 weeks later. And this seems to be, more than anything, the thing that led to Placentophagy's explosion in terms of its popularity. And it could be that there is there's a disgust response associated with thinking about eating this versus consuming this, and that this makes it much more palatable. And if people are telling you there's a lot of good reasons to do it, that you're going to enjoy many benefits from doing it, most every woman that we've talked to says she'd much rather do it this way than this way. And there are some women that eat it raw as well. They usually freeze it, cut it into small pieces, and eat it or blend it into another food. So does encapsulation bypass the olfactory and visual disgust response? Well, perhaps. There's been a lot of media coverage in the US. I do a lot of interviews because people want to know about it. They think it's kind of a strange and funny practice, and so it's a good media story for a newspaper, for a television station, or whatever. So I think that's helped increase the exposure. Who are the advocates and proponents? Well, they're primarily, we found, midwives, doulas, encapsulation specialists. They're the ones that are taking the message of the benefits of Placentophagy to their clients and saying, hey, if you had problems with your milk letdown before, if you had problems with milk production, if you've had some weepiness, if you had some baby blues, or maybe even postpartum depression with your last child, this really helps with mood. This really helps buoy your mood. If you're tired, if you were really, really tired with your last pregnancy, or you're worried about that because you're going to try to, in the US, work right away again after you have your baby, this will help your energy levels. A whole host of things are listed by these proponents as the reasons you would want to consume your placenta after you give birth. So these advocates, and there's others too, I've even talked to some physicians who are advocates of it, who think that there's at least no harm in it, so why not if women want to do it. These advocates claim a variety of postpartum mental health. I just talked about those. Improved mood, energy, lactation, even mother-infant attachment, as though mothers need more of that. From my view, it doesn't seem like we probably do, but there are claims that it even increases bonding. One of the things that advocates do is they emphasize its naturalness. It's place in nature. Placentophagy is something that we see other animals do, and we're just animals, absolutely. But if this is nature's medicine, if this is Mother Nature's way of taking care of mothers after they give birth, then we should be doing it, and we're probably hurting ourselves, their argument goes, by not consuming the placenta. So there must be some natural benefits to the maternal infant pair if it's so common in nature. And there's some good reason to think that that may be true. They also highlight the importance and sacredness of placenta in ancient and small-scale societies. In small-scale societies, as I've told you, we can't find any examples of this, but ancient traditions we have. And here is where advocates view placentophagy in non-Western societies, particularly with respect to traditional Chinese medicine, as confirmation of its efficacy, of its power, and its ancient roots. And Zihe Che, which is dried human placenta in traditional Chinese medicine, it's been a recorded remedy for 5 centuries in traditional Chinese medicine. It is thought this is based on traditional Chinese medicine etiology, right? Theories of disease and how you can affect therapy for patients, but so a very different model than what's being taught in the med school here at Jena. But the idea is based on the traditional Chinese medicine ethnomedical model that it affects the liver, lungs, and kidney, and it is used to treat a whole host of things. So you can go get dried human placenta prescribed to you if you are a person, a woman suffering from infertility, a male suffering from erectile dysfunction, back pain, lightheadedness, low milk supply, interesting, seizures, hot flashes, emaciation, chronic cough, and there are others. So it's prescribed for a whole lot of different things in traditional Chinese medicine. But proponents seize on this and say, hey, ancient wise medical systems have known about this for a long time. We should listen to the wisdom of their traditional therapies. So I'll move through these quickly. Who are these placentophagic moms and why are they doing it? How are they processing it? We published some papers on this recently. And it was also there's also some interesting new data from the CDC in 2017 about maybe some problems with placenta. I know there's a lot on this slide, forgive me. I'll just bring your attention to one thing. These are women who ate their placenta. These are consumers. We looked at over 20,000 women in the US who have midwife-assisted births. And of those 23,000, 7,000 of them ate their placentas. And so we wanted to know something more about them. Basically, they were a little older. They were in their early 30s. They were white, college educated, married, middle income. That was sort of the standard profile of who these women are. So white, college educated, married, middle income. How did they consume their placenta? Well, I'll just bring your attention up here. Dehydrated, uncooked, and encapsulated. 48% of these women, almost half, didn't cook it first. They just dehydrated it without steaming it first. And that makes a lot of physicians uneasy because you're not necessarily killing any pathogens in the tissue. Back to that infection issue we talked about earlier. But nevertheless, half of them did that. And then around 35% of them consumed it, the capsules also, but after they had cooked it. And then you can see a lot of other means as well, but not nearly as common. Why did they do it? 73% of the women, of these 7,000 women that ate their placenta, said they did it to prevent baby blues or postpartum depression. And when you consider that somewhere, according to the World Health Organization, between 10 and 20% of women worldwide suffer from postpartum depression, you can understand why there might be some valid concern on the part of these mothers, these young mothers, about their susceptibility to these affective disorders. So this is motivating them, clearly, when this is the reason given for almost three quarters of them for eating the placenta. By the way, again, for my physician colleagues here especially, was it dangerous? We were really, when we saw the numbers in terms of the number of women that were consuming the placenta without cooking it first, we were very concerned about that because there had been a case of group B strep that was thought to be caused by a mom eating contaminated placenta capsules. And we found that when we did the comparisons between placenta consumers and non-consumers, and we looked at things like neonatal intensive care unit admissions in the first 6 weeks, or neonatal hospitalization, there was no statistically significant difference. In fact, you can see it's actually a little bit less for the women who were consuming. So based on our data, and this is limited data for neonatal health, but this data suggests that there wasn't any significant difference. And this is, of course, including the 50% of women who ate it without cooking it first. Jury's still out, but that does suggest it may not be terribly harmful. Back to the toxic heavy metal thing, we've done tissue studies, as my colleagues here at Jena have. We've looked at heavy metal concentrations back to our fire hypothesis idea. And what we found are things like cadmium, extremely low amounts. You get this much in your drinking water here, probably. This is much less than in your drinking water. So for things like, again, cadmium, mercury, lead, arsenic, the things that we would think could cause real problems for women, they're very, very low. But again, this is in a post-industrial setting where we have clean water and, for the most part, clean air. For women that are in small-scale societies or in developing societies where they're still breathing a lot of toxic fumes, the numbers may be very, very different. So a summary of the current known health risks and benefits, potentially pathogenic organisms. This is from the work of my colleagues here at Jena. They looked at various pathogens, E. coli, and others. They detected it in raw placental tissue. You can see those being detected here. But they were absent after steaming and dehydration, or for the most part, dehydration alone. There really wasn't much of a difference here between steaming it first and dehydrating it versus just dehydrating it. Dehydrating it seemed to eliminate essentially the same number of pathogens as it did steaming it first, which is very interesting because by not steaming it, there were much, much higher concentrations of the hormones that are active in the placenta. Oh my word, I've gone way over. I'm so sorry. Okay. I will just quickly mention, we did do a randomized controlled trial. This is a small pilot phase one trial. We had 27 participants. This is essentially proof of concept and a safety study where we gave women, it was double blind, women either were consuming their own placenta or a placebo. They didn't know which group they were in. And we looked at a whole host of outcomes. So we did find that those hormones, some people had said, by the time you cook this stuff and dehydrate it and get it into capsules, there's not going to be any of the hormones left in this stuff anyway that's going to make any difference. It's just going to be like taking a sugar pill. So we did a study to see if there were indeed those hormones there. There were. They were reduced, but they were there. And then we wanted to see if they actually got into women's circulation. And what we found is they did. And they did in a dose response way. So the more of those hormones that were in the capsules that a woman ate, the higher those levels were in her circulation. We did find that there really was no difference in iron status. A lot of women think that the big reason to take the placenta is it's a great source of heme iron, and so you're less likely to become anemic or be anemic as a result. And we looked over an 8-week period after parturition, and we didn't see any difference in the iron status of women who were eating the placenta versus eating a placebo. So that concentration is pretty high, but if you're anemic, you need a lot more iron than you would ever get in placebo or in placenta capsules. And we didn't find any big differences in maternal mood, bonding, fatigue, or placebo controls. We found some interesting trends, but nothing that really jumps out. It could be that with different dosages, different preparation techniques, that might change. But so far, we don't see, by cooking it, any big advantages for moms in terms of these things, mood, bonding, or fatigue. Future directions. Heavy metal concentration by habitual fire. I still want to make it out to do some field work with my wife, Hamunga Hadza, collect a placenta or two there. Easier said than done, but this is a dream of mine. Comparative placenta preparation methods. This is important, and this is the work that we're going to be doing together in collaboration. As I mentioned, Johnson et al. Show somewhere between 3 and 48 times increase in hormone concentration if you only dehydrate versus cook and dehydrate. And that may be a significant difference when it comes to therapeutic effects, benefits, if moms eat it. Because the women in our study for the randomized controlled trial, that was cooked and dehydrated placenta. So perhaps by dehydrating only, the concentrations will be high enough, we'll see benefits. Pathogenic microbial infection risk. This is another thing that we're doing. We're going to be looking at microbial infection risk here over the next 6 months to a year. Appeal disgust studies. I'm still interested in that as an anthropologist. Why pills are so much more palatable, and then then potentially down the line a phase two randomized trial that would maybe look at different types of placenta preparation techniques. I will mention that there's some interesting studies that have been published recently about some phase three trials for postpartum depression in which they're treating with an injection of allopregnanolone, which is one of the hormones you find in the placenta. And we found that in our placentas, and it was in circulation in these women, at really, really low levels. But this has been shown to be a very, very effective treatment for postpartum depression. It's kind of interesting that that's the case, and it's also something that is found in placentas. So who knows, that may be a clue there. And then ethnographic analysis of placentavagic mothers, advocates, doulas, and others. Thank you all for your attention. I'm sorry I went over my time. I'm happy to take any questions. Yes. you like to join our research team? Very good questions, and right on the money. You raised two great points. One, in nature, these mothers are consuming the placenta, and in most cases, all of it, in one setting. So they're getting a huge infusion of these hormones and other factors that are in the placenta. And it could just be a threshold effect. So maybe there are benefits of eating the placenta, but you've got to eat a whole lot of it in order to get it. So that's one possibility, you're absolutely right. The other possibility is, well, maybe you don't need to eat it all at once, but you can't cook it first or dehydrate it because that's going to reduce the levels of hormones that might be active and beneficial as a result. And Dr. Johnson and Yana and the team here have shown that there is a significant reduction. Interestingly, as I mentioned, by not cooking it, you have a lot more in there than cooking it, even if you dehydrate it. So it could be that there's a step progression. You get almost no hormones or other factors that might be beneficial if you cook it and dehydrate it. You get considerably more if you just dehydrate it, and you get a whole lot if you eat it raw. The problem with eating it raw is the pathogenic load. And you don't want the mom to get group B strep and to pass that on to her infant. I mean, this is incredibly dangerous. So, and it's not just group B strep. I mean, there's other potential pathogens too. So, yes, how would you do that in a clinical study to make sure that there'd have to be a lot of screening. So you'd have to make sure that you screen the moms and the tissue ahead of time to make sure that those pathogenic problems weren't there and then do it. But maybe you could get it through an internal review board. I don't know. Probably not. But great questions. Thank you.
Another question.
Sure.
About the work of Crystal and the placental opioid enhancing factor. I always thought that they were giving opioids, external opioids to the rats, and then saw the... No.
They did do both. So in some of the experimental designs, this is over 30 years Crystal has done these experiments with animals, and in some experimental designs, they did inject opioids, but no, the opioid, the analgesia enhancement is endogenous opioids. So it provides natural, it enhances the natural pain relief that's already there. And what's interesting, I really think there's much more to be done with the POEF for humans, because what's critical about it is it's very heat sensitive. So Crystal has said you can't heat it above, I think, 40 degrees Celsius. And it'll keep frozen, but you can't heat it. So even something like dehydrating tissue, which might reduce some of the pathogen load, is going to deactivate the POEF. But I think its potential pain relieving benefits may be something that's been really overlooked thus far, at least by the human placenta physiology researchers, the few of us that there are. It's just a handful of us in the whole world. Yes.
Thank you very much for this very nice presentation. And very easy to understand and to discuss, I guess.
Oh, thank you.
I have a long list of questions, as I said. Concerning the last topic, the double-blind study, I was thinking about how to expand maybe this study. I guess it makes it makes limited sense to have only blinded study. Maybe what do you guess about a group of patients who really know that they eat placenta, and another group that knows that they really don't eat placenta. Mm-hmm. So to include all these potential placebo effects. Mm-hmm. So because in your double-blind groups, you have also the problem that they may think they receive the placebo.
Sure.
And if you have another group which is sure not to receive the placebo, that may also
affect.
So I'm not sure if this can be included, or I guess it should be included, something like this.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that there are some real advantages of doing an open label study where people know, you know, which group they're in. I guess there are benefits of doing that, and there are disadvantages of doing that, as you said. And perhaps to have an additional arm of the study that would be will be essentially open label. It's certainly, when it comes to the physiological aspects, clearly it wouldn't matter. But so we were interested in so many things, the mood in particular, that might be affected by the expectation of, So we wanted to know if there, with the double blind, if there was an effect that went beyond any sort of placebo improvement. But at this point, maybe an open label could be another avenue of evidence. So,
thank you also for your presentation. At the first part of your presentation, I was at home because I'm an animal doctor. I was astonished to hear that there are no traditional or ethnic sources for placentophagy. My question is, in the classical way, we know three estrogens, estrone, estradiol, estriol, S3. Mm-hmm. Now it's very modern, there's tetrol, estrogen with four hydroxy groups, appearing only in the human placenta. Have you information about this?
No, and this is really, this is out of my depth as an anthropologist. It very well could be if what you're saying is that there is something. Not only are we unusual as a species in terms of not eating the placenta, but there may be some other structural differences in our placentas, hormonal differences in our placentas that might be the reason we don't see these things. It very well could be. I'm not aware of those studies, and again, sort of outside of my area of expertise.
Yes, it's just estetrol is anti-proliferative, strong anti-proliferative action. Could be a
piece of the puzzle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. I will definitely look into this.
Yeah, yeah.
By people who know more than I have. Other questions?
You mentioned that
some
hormones are slightly increased in those women
who
consume the protein. Which hormones specifically?
Well, we looked at a suite of 15. So we looked at estradiol, estrone. We looked at testosterone. We looked at it's in the paper. I'm happy to send it to you. But we were limited somewhat by the panel that the lab that we worked with could run these, because it was a method that they used was mass spectrometry, and these were saliva samples. So we needed really the accuracy of these to be very, very high, because we knew these levels were going to be very low. So we essentially had to run the hormone panel that they had developed for it. But we felt like the ones we were the most interested in were the estrogens, E1, E2, and E3.
Non-proteic.
Yeah,
hormones,
yeah.
Essentially.
Prolactin as well, beside the steroid hormones.
Once the placenta is ingested, so it's degraded,
mm-hmm.
and absorbed in pieces, and then some metabolites. In the case of prolactin, it will be degraded in the stomach.
Yes.
Not absorbed directly. So what's the connection with prolactin, for example?
Well, I mean, that was one of the questions. I mean, we weren't sure. There were plenty of physicians and others, endocrinologists, were saying, that's fine, you can find prolactin or progesterone or whatever in the tissue, but it's not necessarily going to be taken up by the body's tissues once a woman ingests it. And so we said, okay, well, that very well could be, but let's test it and find out. Let's see how much of these hormones are in the tissue after it's processed, which is what we did. And then let's see, after the women consume these capsules, how much of it ends up in their systemic circulation. And we did show that there's a dose-response relationship, that those things do end up in circulation. Now, very, very small increases, but it is a dose-response relationship. So I think the principle, but the amounts the team here has shown, the amounts are so small that it could be that there's just this threshold that we need to get to, and that if that if we're not cooking the placenta before it is dehydrated, that there may be enough of some of these hormones into circulation to make a difference. Prolactin, probably not. We actually have a paper coming out shortly. We looked at the effect on prolactin and infant neonatal weight gain over the first 6 weeks. No difference. But between the prolactin levels in the blood and in the neonatal weight gain. But it could just be a matter of a preparation technique too, and not have as much to do with prolactin. That's the obvious one, but there are other lactogenic hormones that may be important.
And I would like to add a comment on your question, because this was always a question that we had. If you imagine to heat cook the placental hormones, like most of them are protein hormones, then they are degraded anyways, then you put them into capsules, and these are digested by the stomach acid, and the proteins are degraded as well. So I would not expect any bioactivity from digested hormones. But if you compare the placentophagy with mammals, then they have like a whole piece that is raw. And if you imagine that the boar or a hamster is chewing the raw tissue, and you have this pretty well, the oral mucosa that is well distributed. What's the word for it? A lot of blood flow in the oral mucosa, and you don't have the first pass effect through the liver because it's not absorbed through the gut, but it's absorbed through the mucosa. Then there are hypotheses that small peptide hormones, for example, oxytocin is 9 amino acids long, could travel through extracellular space and have an internal effect. So they measured, for example, the nasal application of insulin or oxytocin, and then the concentration in the cerebral CSF, cerebral spinal fluid. And you could see that in apes, for example, you can measure this concentration. And the hypothesis is that, yeah, it's well absorbed through the oral mucosa. But for humans who consume just a small amount in one capsule, and the capsule itself, I would not expect too much bioavailability.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't catch all that. So the consuming the placenta would do what with respect to the future pregnancy? Forgive me.
Yeah, so just as a source of antigens to promote immune tolerance against antigen or peptide.
Yeah.
Okay, so with the possibility to have a posterior immune tolerance or increasement of immune tolerance against peptide antigens?
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating question. I mean, I don't know. I just don't know. I suppose it's a possibility. Again, that's sort of out of my depth, to be honest with you. But it's an interesting idea. One that I'll think about and talk to some people that know more about that approach than I. Thank you.
I have a smaller comment on the encapsulation of the placenta, particularly the antigen, the capsula, and should actually go as a capsula through the stomach. So the idea is that you get it through the stomach and then it can be absorbed by the mucosa in the gut, I think. So maybe the stomach is not having such a big effect on dehydrating anymore.
The capsule protects from stomach acid, and then it's
it has to be a pretty special capsule, right?
Yes.
I mean, yeah.
Or the inside of the capsule is somehow coated with something.
Right.
Then it will go through.
But I mean, we know it's likely it depends on the peptide right, or the hormone. I mean, the, for some of them, we know progesterone, for example. Women are taking synthetic progesterone for birth control all the time orally. These could be effective, and others as well. In other cases, for the peptide hormones, they're likely degrading them so greatly that there likely isn't any sort of physiological effect. But again, I think our study has shown at least a proof of concept that some of these we can see these dose response effects, and perhaps with higher concentrations we may get some more clues. Yes?
Is it known if
it's
possible to measure
this
indication of future pregnancies or future behaviors in animals or humans?
Yes, great question. Yes. So animals that engage in placentophagy are much more likely to engage in placentophagy in the future. So, and this is, we certainly see this in primate species and in rodents as well. So a high percentage of rodents engage in placentophagy at some point in their lives, but the ones that engage in it early typically do with every pregnancy.
Do you know about the use of placenta in farm animals and agriculture? Mm-hmm. So what is happening to placenta after delivery?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. You know,
they must know. They make money with it.
Yeah. I don't think that they. I know that I come from a rural background. I have a lot of family members who are farmers, extended family, and I've talked to them about it. It's interesting. Consistently, I've heard people say, for mares, when after they deliver, they'll take the placenta away from the mares because there's a belief among a lot of large animal vets that it causes some particular gastrointestinal problem, some sort of colic that they call it, that requires surgery. And so they'll often remove the placenta from horses. Now, horses, free-range horses, they've shown a small percentage of them will engage in placentophagy if given the opportunity, around 10%. But for a lot of domesticated horses that are birthing in barns and so forth, the ranchers will take the placenta away. For cattle, my dad grew up on a farm. I've talked to him about this a lot. But he says he's never seen a heifer or a cow give birth and not eat something. So, and I think that that's pretty typical. And farmers and ranchers will allow their animals to eat it. And the same with goats. Very much placentophages, also sheep. So I think typically farmers just let the animals do what they will with it.
Except kind of flexories and huge, so where they have hundreds of thousands of placentas.
Right.
It's interesting to know if this is, or if they feel it's somehow helpful for the animals, or if they use the placenta for whatever else.
It's a great question. So in terms of factory farms, I don't know, but I'm definitely going to find out now. Yeah, that's
and
a great question.
I can add a comment because I was asking everyone about placentas and also farmers in the Thuringian area when I was in my Weimarer Land duty. And so they also said that in the Massen industry, they remove the placentas from the cows because they think they get trouble, too much gas. And they have different kind of stomach, yeah, seven stomachs,
yeah,
cows.
Four.
And they are not able to digest placenta.
And maybe some further questions in this regard. You said, so the mothers prefer placenta when they are offered alternatively meat or placenta. What about competition for